Thank you. Please be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Carpenter versus Cimarron.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas Michelle is an argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Thomas Michelle, and I am David Evans and Mike Miller and Christopher Forbes represent the petitioners in this case. And today we are faced or presented with an interesting and compelling issue with regard to the application, if any, of Craddock to Texas summary judgment practice. The petitioners contend or we challenge in this appeal essentially in four levels of four primary areas why this judgment of the Court of Appeals should be reversed. One is that Craddock should not apply to summary judgment proceedings. Two, if this court so holds that Craddock should apply to summary judgment practice, it should not apply in this case because a default did not occur in the trial below. Three, the Court of Appeals judgment and opinion impermissibly overrules a prior opinion of the same panel.
Can we make that judgment? I mean, we could reverse a judgment of the Court of Appeals because the panel didn't follow an earlier panel decision?
Well, I would think in this particular situation, it probably would be the only court left to do it.
But I mean, you think that's error. That is a legal error.
I do.
For one panel not to follow its other, a previous decision, and do you have a citation?
Well, the basis for the genesis comes from the O'Connor opinion and also the cite of the Baker case, in which a panel of one court should not override the panel decision of another court. That's cited, both of those cases are cited in our brief. And in the O'Connor opinion, this court goes in depth to say that the panel makeup of the Court of Appeals was modeled after the federal procedure, which, of course, there are numerous cases that say that one panel of the Court of Appeals cannot overrule another panel.
Okay, well, then I'll just get a real easy question. Do you have a single United States Supreme Court cite reversing a Court of Appeals decision because a panel overruled another panel?
No. And four, if Craddock does apply and this court determines that this is a default judgment situation, that the respondent in this case failed to carry its burden, that it did not have conscious indifference.
Well, let me ask you this. You've said that you think there should be, we should apply a traditional abuse of discretion standard to review the trial court's rulings before the summary judgment hearing took place, the motion for leave to file and the motion for continuance. How would you define the parameters of that abuse of discretion standard, and more specifically, without saying Craddock applies because of default or no default, why wouldn't you apply the same equitable Craddock standards in that situation and use those same considerations to define the parameters of the trial court's discretion?
With regards to the motion for leave and continuance standard, Your Honor, as I take that question, there is case law out there that applies the good cause standard, I believe, in the Haynes case, 35 Southwest 3166, that applies the good cause standard and the summary judgment motion for leave standard. And they differentiate the difference between the conscious indifference standard and the good cause standard on the basis that counsel's inadvertence is not sufficient. And so I think that would be the guiding principle in the motion for leave situation. As the court is familiar, in this situation, I will go briefly into the facts because I think a factual recitation is very important.
Is there any case law in Texas in which a trial court has denied a motion for leave to file a late response to a summary judgment motion, in which a court of appeals has determined, or this court has determined, that the motion for denial of the motion for leave was an abuse of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, and under what circumstances has that been determined to be an abuse of discretion? Can you give us some of the factual parameters?
Yes, certainly, Your Honor. I believe in some of the briefs some of the cases we cited this court, the examples of where a trial court has abused its discretion is, for instance, I believe it was in the, forgetting the name of the case, but I forget the parameter with regard to which the court has held that an abuse of discretion has existed is whether there was not sufficient time to respond or the counsel's presented arguments that their inability to respond was due to some of more the traditional external forces, not necessarily the neglect or inadvertence event.
Like what?
An unforeseen event, the inability to obtain discovery, things of that nature that would be in the form of a motion for leave.
Is there any case law in which a trial court has abused its discretion for failing to grant leave in a case such as this where there is some allegation of a mistake on the part of the lawyer?
I haven't seen any. The closest that comes that I think that are cited in the briefs are when the Court of Appeals that have applied the Craddock standard felt that the attorneys in those cases did not meet the conscious indifference standard. I haven't found any.
But those were all in connection with motions for a new trial.
Yes.
After the fact, when there had been no appearance before the court rendered judgment on the summary judgment motion.
But that's correct, Your Honor.
I'm talking about in the context of using the procedural requirements of Rule 166A pre-decision by the court on the summary judgment motion.
No, I'm not.
Has that ever been a factor before that you know of in any case law?
I'm not aware of it, Your Honor. Not aware of it. Situation.
Let me redirect your attention. I think you've been addressing the denial of a motion for leave to file a late response. How would you define the parameters of a trial court's abuse of discretion denying the motion for continuance? There's not much, the trial court has pretty unfettered discretion in that regard, wouldn't you agree?
I think so. I think that probably the guiding principle to look to, obviously, is this court's opinion in Tenneco, although it doesn't really give a standard per se. On the abuse of discretion standard, it does outline in a pretty detailed what is required in a motion for continuance, the specificity of the discovery required, the materiality of the discovery needed, the attempts to obtain the discovery. So, and I think, Your Honor, you're correct. I don't know if there's per se a standard that has been applied in that situation, but the court has given a good guideline.
And my next question then is what would be, you've named some sort of equitable things. What's wrong with importing some of the equitable pieces of Craddock into defining the trial court's parameters for abuse of discretion in that context?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think in that situation, the court should look into all of the surrounding circumstances that go into a motion for leave or a continuance. I think the procedures set up by the rules and by the case law would significantly help if it's encompassing all of the factors that are presented to the trial court. And I would think at that motion for leave status for the motion for continuance, you would set forth all of your grounds, whether they be legal or equitable.
If I understand correctly, the matters that were raised by the motion for new trial in this case, the calendaring situation, the communications between the lawyers who were representing the non-movement, none of that was raised in connection with the motion for leave or the motion for continuance. Is that correct?
It was argued at the motion for leave. It was not presented in the motion for leave itself.
But it was argued. It was brought to the trial court's attention?
Yes, Your Honor. And it was brought in the motion for continuance as well. Argued, I should say.
But not in the motion itself?
Not in the motion itself. The body of the motion for leave itself is extremely short, and it doesn't state why it needs the leave. In the motion for continuance, it kind of takes a contrary position and says, we need more discovery. And that has never been presented before at any time until the day of that hearing. And, of course, at the time the extension was granted, the first extension was granted to the June 4th date, no statement at that time, because it was agreed by both counsel on both sides of the case, that additional discovery was needed at that point.
Let me ask you one more question to clear up what the record looks like in the trial court. Craddock was raised by the non-movement in the motion for new trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
So when the trial court held its hearing, did the trial court hold a Craddock hearing at that point in time?
By all intents and purposes, I don't think it's stated explicitly on the record, but the hearing certainly was the testimony, the line of questioning, the arguments were all Craddock related. The respondent certainly asserted and briefed the issue for the court, holding that Craddock was the standard to be applied.
Well, in connection with denying the motion for new trial, did the trial court give any indication of whether or not it considered Craddock as the basis for its decision and analyzed the evidence that had been presented in connection with the Craddock requirements?
From the face of the record, I don't think you can tell, Your Honor. Certainly, I think it's fair to say that the court, in deference, probably did consider it and rejected it.
There have been several scholarly articles and CLE speeches on this subject since the conflict has arisen, and its respondents cited us, of course, only the ones that papered their position. Is there some neutral scholarship out there that supports your position?
We have not located any at this point, Your Honor, that would necessarily be favorable to our position. There's Timothy Patton's article that I don't think is necessarily critical of it. It just, I think, raises your attention to it, saying that this is an issue that's out there. Beware of it. Besides the conflicting cases.
Seems to be the argument, and the argument that you make, not seems to me, you make the argument, that Craddock, if the elements of Craddock are proven, then the trial court must grant the new trial. There's no discretion, must grant it. Implicit in that is the argument that if you're really checking abuse of discretion for failure to grant the continuance or grant the late filed pleading, that you could establish the Craddock elements and the trial court still deny leave to file or deny the continuance and not abuse its discretion. I mean, without calling it Craddock or not, if those elements were in fact proven at the brought to the court's attention for the on the leave to file late, what else would the trial judge be allowed to rely on to avoid having abuse of discretion, I guess is my point. What would be different that would allow the trial court to ignore the Craddock items and decide they're going to stick with denying leave to file?
If you don't mind, I may try to rephrase your question. Is it you're saying what is the standard or what the trial court should apply at that motion for leave status, if not Craddock? Is that essentially or those?
Well, your argument is that Craddock would prevent a trial court from exercising its discretion to deny leave to file.
Right.
And I was arguing what is there left in the trial, assuming, forget about calling it Craddock, just say those elements are established at the hearing, what other factors would a trial court be able to rely on to exercise its discretion not to grant the leave to file?
One example comes, and I think it's in play in this case, is if, for in fact, a defective or deficient motion for leave is in fact filed. Hence, I think when the trial court is presented with that factual situation with a defective motion for leave, and it's just because, judge, let's go ahead and grant this motion, and then later on it's developed in the motion for new trial, which is exactly what I think happened in this case. At the motion for new trial, they go ahead and present all of the things that they probably should have presented at the motion for leave standard. I think that's a classic example of where you would be forced to grant the Craddock motion, and the trial court would have been correct to deny the motion for leave. And I think that is our position here, is that really, and I don't think the respondents even argue on appeal to the court below or in this court, that the trial court erred in denying the motion for leave because it was on its face defective. So consequently, the trial court, in our brief to this court, is kind of handcuffed into granting that motion.
While in this case you don't think that Craddock should apply, for one reason is because you say there is no default. If we had before us the circumstance in which there was a problem with respect to the notice of the summary judgment hearing or receipt of the summary judgment motion or something, so that the non-movement wholly failed to appear and participate in the summary judgment process and judgment was rendered against the non-movement, similar to someone not appearing for trial, then do you think that Craddock should apply in the context of a motion for new trial? And is that, and would the reason be because then a default does occur?
I would say, Your Honor, that certainly does present a more difficult situation. And I think the analogies are somewhat closer. However, in our first position would be no, that Craddock does not apply even in that situation. I think the standard that could apply would still be the motion for leave standard. And the alternative
You mean the motion for leave to after the judgment had been entered to
absolutely. I think,
reconsider and...
Yes, and I think to try to keep it consistent maybe is at some point, whether it's 7 days out, whether it's the day of the hearing, or whether it's within the 30-day period.
But if judgment has been rendered against me on the merits, and I did not participate in any way in the summary judgment proceedings, never got the motion, never filed a response, didn't appear at the hearing, then why isn't that similar to a default that occurs in connection with a failure to appear at trial? I didn't get notice of the trial setting. I didn't show up. The court went forward. The opposing party put on their case, just like in a summary judgment proceeding, the movement would have put on their case, judgment rendered against me on the merits. Why don't the equities play similarly in the summary judgment default circumstance as to a failure to appear at trial default?
Thank you. I think the court in your question, you really posed two hypotheticals mixed in one question. One is you don't get notice. And we're not arguing that Craddock or even a lesser standard wouldn't apply if you had no notice.
Talking about you just don't appear, whatever the reason. And the Craddock motion is designed, one of the things it's designed to do is to sort out why you weren't there and excuse your failure to participate.
Well, I would say one is, I think inherently, is what we're trying to preserve with the Craddock situation is if there's a defect. I think the traditional Craddock situation that almost all practitioners are familiar with is the no-answer default situation. And in that situation, there are no procedural remedies in place at that time, no other alternatives that would give notice to a litigant about upcoming deadlines. You've gotten the notice, it's the one shot, and judgment is entered. Here you're already engaged in the litigation process. Here, presumably, you have gotten notice, the litigant has gotten proper notice, so the procedural safeguard there is there. Then, assuming
well, the same thing is true for a trial. There when you go to trial too. Right. I mean,
yes, they are absolutely. And what I'm getting to is, if you've gotten that procedural safeguard, then your second alternative built into the rule, which I would argue is the motion for leave status, which and we're not going to. It's not necessarily, and I don't think we're mincing words. The standard, the applicable standard, may be at the heart of this issue. But what is the standard to apply? And if we're mixing names, you've got the whole Craddock apparatus that you apply from a default situation. It's been modified a little bit in the summary judgment context. And maybe it's the standard. And in deference to an alternative position, perhaps the conscious indifference standard could apply in that situation.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please report? Mr. John Murphy will present argument from respondent.
And may it please the court, my name is John Murphy, and I represent the respondent, Cimarron Hydrocarbons, in this case. And I have a number of holes to poke in petitioners' more puzzling and alarming arguments, both in their brief on the merits and in their oral argument here today.
Why don't you start by telling us why, if you actually appear and participate in the summary judgment proceeding, filing a motion for leave to file a late response, motion for continuance, participate in the hearing, why under those circumstances there is a default when, in fact, defaults typically arise when there has been no when the party has not been heard? I'm having a hard time putting this in the default cubbyhole.
The essential thing to remember with regard to motions for summary judgment is that the default does not occur with regard to the non-moving party on the day of the hearing. It occurs 7 days prior to the hearing.
No, a default occurs when judgment is taken against you. And so the default occurs after the fact that when the trial court signs the judgment, rendering judgment against you.
Actually, Your Honor, I'd make a distinction there between the default, the act of default, and the default judgment entered by the court. The default occurs when the party fails to do something which they were obligated by the rules of procedure
but
to
if
do.
I fail to file an answer on the Monday following 20 days, I may leave myself open for a default, but I have not truly defaulted, and default has not occurred until the court enters judgment against me.
Again, I would make a distinction.
If I file an answer on that Tuesday and get to the courthouse before you do with your default motion, judgment motion, the trial court can't enter a default judgment against
because
me.
Because the default has been cured, but the default occurs on Monday at 10 o'clock when the answer is not filed. the default judgment may not be entered until sometime later, and a party has the opportunity to cure the default before the judgment is entered. The same thing happens with regard to summary judgments 7 days before the summary judgment hearing. With regard
well, you
to
have an opportunity, if it is a default, you have an opportunity to cure the default with your motion for leave and motion for continuance.
Well, you certainly have the opportunity to try and cure the default. It's different from a true default judgment where you have a filed answer, because if you get that answer on file in a true default, no answer case, if you get your answer on file before the court enters the judgment, then you've cured the default. However, in a summary judgment context, you don't necessarily have that absolute right. The trial court can do what the trial court did in this case, deny the motion for continuance, deny the motion to file the leave, or leave to file the late response.
You will agree that your definition of default does not comport with how this court has characterized default in the various circumstances in which we recognized it.
Are you asking with regard to...
When we talk about a default occurring as a result of failing to file an answer, we have traditionally referred to the point in time where the court enters judgment. Similarly, when judgment is entered after trial, when there is a failure to appear at trial. So you're asking us to expand the concept of default because it doesn't comport with the traditional definition of when a default judgment occurs.
I'm not sure that's what I'm asking, Your Honor. It may be that my understanding of when a default occurs is defective, but I would suggest to the court that the act of default, the failure of a party to do something which is required by the rules of procedure, and the default judgment itself are two different things.
Let me ask you about the details of Craddock.
Yes, sir.
Craddock has three pieces. We've talked somewhat about general equitable concerns. And I'd like to shelve that for a second and just talk about the specifics of credit. You could apply the third prong fairly easily. Has the other party been prejudiced? Are you willing to compensate for the prejudice? So he showed up the motion, he incurred some attorney fees, you may have to reimburse that. That would be a credit concern. It seems that you could apply that in the summary judgment context just like you could in the default judgment. Do you disagree with that?
I don't disagree with that. That's a fairly easy.
Meritorious defense is hard.
Yes, it is.
Because for a new trial, you don't have to prove that you're going to win. You just have to prove that you might. Here, there's no analog in the summary judgment context. If you have a response that gets you there, you've won. And if you don't, you lose. How do you apply that element of Craddock in this
situation? Well, the courts of appeals, which have applied Craddock to the default summary judgment context, have said that proving a meritorious defense in the summary judgment context means raising a fact issue on each of the claims that are challenged by the summary judgment movement.
But then you won. I mean, it's totally different from the motion for new trial.
No.
You haven't won the case when you set up a meritorious defense and a motion for new trial.
Precisely. You haven't won the case when you raise a meritorious defense by raising a fact issue in a default summary judgment context either. All you've done is put the case on track for a trial on the merits.
But you've won the summary judgment.
That's
proceeding.
True. Yes.
So
or
that
is the ultimate resolution of the summary judgment proceeding.
But it's not the ultimate resolution of the case, and that's an important distinction to make.
But that means these deadlines are not really deadlines.
Well, they are deadlines if Craddock is the standard, because then the trial court has some guiding rule, some guiding principle to determine whether to allow a late filed response.
And isn't that guiding principle? That seems to be what we're about here, because the element three is always easily taken care of. The second element, I don't see how it fits. The first element, it seems to be what the fuss is over, and that is, should you get past this problem, or a lack of conscious indifference, or at some point the bar goes high. If you fail to make an objection to evidence, if you fail to object to the charge, we don't relieve you of that failure because you weren't consciously indifferent. We said, well, you had your chance, it's over. Way back at the beginning, if you fail to file an answer, we say, well, that's too early, we can't tell for sure. So we've set the bar pretty high, no conscious indifference. Why should we set the bar here at a lack of conscious indifference? Why shouldn't it be lack of ordinary care or lack of good practices or something like that?
Your Honor, the threshold should be the Craddock threshold, because when a party fails to respond to a motion for summary judgment, it is an outcome determinative mistake.
That's true for waiving an appellate point, for not filing your brief on time. I mean, throughout the whole pretrial trial and appellate process, there are ways you can lose your case.
And
I don't know how you make the distinction once the parties are before the court.
There are certainly many ways that you can affect the outcome of your case, but there are relatively few where the failure to do something results in a judgment almost
immediately. But you can lose a summary judgment motion even if the other side doesn't file. That's not automatically outcome determinative, because it's on its own face it can collapse.
Yes, on its face
so,
it can.
So this is not, I mean, in your particular case it might have been outcome determinative, but that's not a universal rule.
The difference there is that whether the summary judgment movement's evidence and motion for summary judgment are sufficient to justify judgment as a matter of law is not something which is in the control of the responding party. That's an important distinction to make.
Excuse me, say that again. I didn't understand that.
Whether the summary judgment movement, let's just say it easier, whether the motion for summary judgment and the summary judgment evidence is sufficient to support a judgment, considering only the motion and only the evidence that is filed by the proponent, is something which is not within the control of the summary judgment respondent. See, that makes a difference. For instance, when a plaintiff files a petition at the onset of a lawsuit, well, now I've lost my train of thought, but the important thing to remember is that we certainly could have, and in fact we did, go to the trial court that day and argue against the motion for summary judgment.
Why don't you have enough protection with the procedural rules that are already in place? You can get leave to file late. You can move for a continuance. Even after the judgment has been taken, you can also move the trial court at that point in time after the hearing for a late filed evidence to reconsider the summary judgment motion. Why aren't there plenty of procedural protections built into the place in summary judgment practice as it is to give you the opportunity to have presented to the trial judge everything you've presented post-judgment? You could have presented pre-summary judgment hearing in connection with the motion for leave and the motion for continuance.
I agree with you wholeheartedly that the procedural framework is in place to cure mistakes like the mistake that was made in this case. The thing that's missing in Texas jurisprudence is the guiding rule or principle that's going to inform the trial court's discretion.
You want us to say essentially that any time counsel, the secretary makes a mistake and it's inadvertent, they're automatically entitled to continuance. And that would be the effect of this rule. Because if you had presented those grounds in your motion for continuance, your position is the trial court has to grant that motion.
I'm not sure that we're arguing that that would apply in a motion for continuance.
What's the difference? I mean, how can the trial court have not abused its discretion on a lack of just inadvertence on your part? If she says, no, you don't get a continuance, grant summary judgment against you, then the motion for new trial on credit grounds is required to grant you a new trial. I mean, that seems disproportionate to me. It seems like if the trial court has to give you a new trial, if you bring it up post-judgment, the trial court also would have to give you a continuance pre-hearing.
And I agree that that would be the better practice, because if the trial court were to grant us either a continuance or an opportunity to file a late response at that time, there would be the absolute minimum of prejudice and delay. If you have to wait until an opportunity to file and have heard a motion for new trial, then there's necessarily going to be some amount of delay,
so
about a month and a half.
All of our pretrial deadlines, after if we were to rule for you from henceforth, our pretrial deadlines are all subject to being mandatorily set aside by the trial court if counsel says, I'm sorry, I just didn't calendar it and I missed the deadline.
I think that where counsel can show an actual mistake and disprove conscious indifference and intentional conduct, that should be the rule.
But isn't it true that in Craddock, there's a reason for the guiding principle there is, in many of those cases, when there's no answer to default judgment, the defendant didn't have a lawyer, the citation may arrive by publication, and so there's not even actual notice, and And what we are saying, what we were saying in Craddock, is that that person probably has a right to defend himself or herself in court if there's been some sort of mistake made. But here, once the answer is filed, an attorney is hired to represent that defendant, that attorney has notice of the hearing, then all of those equitable ideas in Craddock just simply don't really apply in this context, do they?
Well, it's important to remember that that there are pure default, no answer cases that apply Craddock where the defendant did have an attorney and where the attorney simply forgot to file the answer on time and the party was given a new trial there. So it's not as though we're expanding Craddock to an area or a procedural situation in which it's never applied before, because it has applied in that precise circumstance. Clerical errors, calendaring mistakes, those have been used to justify a new trial under Craddock in the past.
So where do you, I think that you can hear the court's concern as to where we draw the lines here. Let's say you send a request for admissions that are going to be outcome determinative, and the time goes by and you miscalendar them. Are we going to apply Craddock there?
Well, the rules say that if you can show good cause for failure to respond to a request for admission in time, that the court can.
Well, that's why don't we also apply that in this context, because the rules also provide procedural safeguards. Why don't we stick with the procedural safeguards that the rules already apply?
Well, I would suggest to the court, first of all, that good cause by itself is a lower standard than Craddock. Craddock is you have to negate conscious indifference and intentional conduct, and you have to show a meritorious defense, and you have to show the absence of undue prejudice or delay. Now, those second two may not always be particularly onerous burdens, but good cause is an even lower threshold, even easier to prove. It doesn't have those other two elements. You don't have to negate conscious indifference or intentional conduct. You just have to have some good cause.
But you're saying, again, we would be saying that failure to properly calendar is automatically good cause as a matter of law.
If that's what the evidence showed, then I think that would be good cause. Now, that doesn't mean that in every case where an attorney alleges a calendaring mistake that they are automatically going to be entitled to a new trial.
They read an affidavit from their secretary, and she says,
That's clearly the law. If all you have is a calendaring mistake, how can that be conscious indifference? You would never lose that case. You said it might be different in some other case. It can't be.
Well, there are some cases that have applied Craddock in the no-answer summary judgment context where an attorney said he didn't know about the hearing, that he did not receive notice of the summary judgment hearing. And circumstantial evidence showed that he sure should have known about it, that he had constructive knowledge of it, and therefore did not meet the first prong of Craddock. The case I'm talking about is Gonzalez out of the Beaumont Court of Appeals in 1993, where the attorney, the court said, was guilty of the selective acceptance of certified mail. He simply refused to accept the certified letter that set the hearing. And the court found that even though he might not actually have known that the hearing had been set, still, he was guilty of intentional or consciously indifferent conduct.
What is conscious indifference? I mean, what if you have sloppy calendaring procedures in your office?
I would suggest that that is negligence as opposed to conscious indifference. Conscious indifference is to know that one is obligated to do something and to consciously choose not to do anything about it. Negligence, by the way, is not the test in Craddock. Even a negligent mistake will satisfy the first prong of Craddock. A slight mistake will satisfy
Don't
the
you
first
see
prong.
Some danger, though, in the rule you're advocating here? You know, if a lawyer comes to within days of a summary judgment knowing that the hearing is there and just for whatever reason didn't get the job done, then there's going to be an affidavit from him or for his secretary in order to avoid a case dispositive ruling on summary judgment. So don't you see that if we adopt Craddock here, that that's going to be, it's going to give free rein to lawyers to just come up with any mistake and avoid summary judgments altogether, or get much more time for discovery?
Well, first of all, let me address the much more time for discovery. It doesn't necessarily do that, because if one has failed to respond to a motion for summary judgment, as happened in this case, and the evidence that exists at the time the response should have been filed is sufficient to overcome the motion for summary judgment, then I think Craddock should apply, and I think that the attorney should be given a second chance. If, however, the party must develop evidence after they have failed to file the response, and it is based on that evidence that they think they are entitled to a new trial, then I would say that they have not met their burden under
Well, that's what happened in this case, because the expert's affidavit was post-dated after the hearing by several weeks, wasn't it?
Yes, but the expert's affidavit is not necessary to overcome the motions for summary judgment. And I wish we hadn't filed that expert's affidavit. It would have simplified the case considerably. The Court of Appeals found, and if you look at the record, you will see that the evidence we wanted to file with our late response on the day of the summary judgment hearing is sufficient to overcome the motion for summary judgment.
Was that provided to the trial court as part of the motion to leave?
A copy of the motion was attached, or a copy of the response was attached to the motion, yes.
In their reply brief, the petitioners raised the question whether you would apply this same standard process to defective responses as opposed to no response at all. The affidavit was accidentally left off, something was through typing error, something was left out. Would you apply it there as well, or just to no response?
Well, that's the beauty of the Craddock test. What we're talking about here is an equitable remedy. And when you have an equitable remedy, it is necessarily a fact-intensive inquiry. That is to say, the trial court is going to have to look at the facts and circumstances of that particular case.
Let me put it to you this way. If the affidavit is left off the response, and the lawyer comes in and says, "Judge, I was not consciously indifferent. I was just negligent. It was just a mistake." Is that enough to get him by or not?
I think it should be, yes.
Well, why wouldn't that apply to, as the Chief pointed out, objections to the jury charge? I come in with a sheaf of pre-typed objections to the jury charge, and my secretary, when she was collating them, left one out. And then on appeal, I said, "I intended to object. It was just negligence on my part. I wasn't consciously indifferent."
The failure to object to a question on a jury charge is not necessarily going to be outcome determinative.
Well, let's say in that case it is.
That is a tough one to answer. Again, because we're talking about an equitable remedy, I would say it would depend on the facts and circumstances present in that case. Of course, under the laws that now exist, that is not grounds for relief that you forgot to object. You have to make the objection at a particular point in time. The difference between that situation...
As you have to file a response to a motion for summary judgment. I mean, I just see a hole here that's saying, was negligent would apply to virtually every deadline in the rule book.
And in fact, it already does apply to several deadlines that are in the rule book.
Well, and it seems like the distinction to be drawn with Justice Owens' example is you've got a party before the court, and in the default situation, you don't have a party before the court, which gets us back to our original question as to why the procedural safeguards already in place in the summary judgment context aren't sufficient, because if you are there to file a motion for leave and move for continuance, you have a party before the court and different procedural rules should apply.
Well, I think the question is, clearly the trial court has the discretion to grant the motion for continuance, to grant the motion for leave to file the late response, to grant a new trial after judgment has been rendered. The question is, what rule, what guiding principle is going to inform that discretion? And that's what we're here to talk about today.
That's the key issue. I mean, is negligence going to be, in every case, as a matter of law, good cause under the rules?
Again, it depends on the facts and circumstances, but if the uncontroverted evidence shows negligence, shows a mistake, then I think it should be grounds for a new trial.
I'm a little bit confused. I thought that your position in this case was that Craddock should apply in connection with a motion for a new trial filed after a summary judgment has been rendered against a non-movement.
Correct.
You're still holding that position. You're not saying to us that we should apply Craddock to the procedures already in place with the motion for leave and motion for continuance.
Well, I think the court doesn't even have to reach that question, whether it applies to a continuance or a motion for leave, because those are subsumed within the new trial standard.
But you see the incongruity. The trial court could have, under our existing practice, could say, "Well, I find that negligence in failing to properly calendar is not a valid basis. I'm not going to give you continuance," and proceeds with the summary judgment motion. But then if the new trial's motion for new trial stage would be required as a matter of law to grant a new trial. So it would seem incongruous to say, "Well, no, that's not a good grounds for continuance or for a leave to file late," but it mandates a new trial. I mean, do you see that?
I do see that, and that's why I think it would be the better practice to apply the Craddock standard at as early a stage in the litigation or at an earliest stage after the default as possible. Less delay, less prejudice, less cost.
But Mr. Murphy, with the exception of the expert affidavit that was evidently signed after the summary, at some point in time after the summary judgment hearing, did you have the opportunity and did you, in fact, apprise the trial court of everything that you apprised the trial court of in the motion for new trial at the time of the motion for leave and the motion for continuance?
All of that was contained in, not contained in, but attached to the motion for leave to file a late response. So if the court had decided to read through the late response, it would have had notice of everything we were arguing.
But I'm talking about the other things, too. The mistake, how it occurred, everything associated with that. There was nothing new with the exception of the expert affidavit presented to the trial court in connection with the motion for new trial.
That's essentially correct. The one thing I would add to that is that on the day of the summary judgment hearing, we weren't sure how this had happened. How had we blown this date? And we discovered that between the summary judgment and the motion for new trial.
So you didn't tell them, I mean, what did you say to the trial court about why the response had not been timely filed?
Simply that it was a calendaring mistake because it was not on my calendar. And that's all. We didn't know how it had not made it to my calendar.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The respondents are distancing themselves from that expert affidavit. It is clear in the record at page 179 in the clerk's record that Aldridge testified that he needed the continuance as a basis, and specifically he stated in particular to retain an expert in order to respond to the liability and damages issues. At page 167 and at page 6 on the reporter's record volume 2, the respondents asserted that Aldridge would obtain an expert testimony to use in the response.
If conscious indifference is not the standard, what is the standard?
At what stage? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
To get this set aside, to get the summary judgment set aside.
If conscious indifference is not the standard, I would say it would be a motion for reconsideration.
Based on what, though? What's the standard? What do you have to show?
Good cause.
And it's
and
good
why isn't calendaring error good cause?
I don't think calendaring...
It can happen to anybody.
It can. Absolutely, it can happen to anybody, including myself. I think the calendaring mistake issue is not sufficient in the good...
Why?
Why is it not sufficient? I think you have to go into the details, once again, of the calendaring mistake. Once again, I think it begs the question, is a calendaring mistake just simple, flat-out negligence? And if that's the standard, I think it will be very...
What if it's complicated, sympathetic, explainable negligence?
Which is what I would do.
Yeah. the kind that you and I commit. Not the kind everybody else does.
Exactly. I think it's certainly... There's different levels. I think there's certainly different levels. I think in the abstract, if you just say calendaring mistake, I think that's kind of, quite frankly, a simple, vague response. We certainly contest in this case that it wasn't a calendaring mistake in no way, shape, or form. This is not the case of where they simply forgot to put it on the calendar. It was on the only Council of Records calendar. It was on his secretary's calendar. And the fallacy in the whole calendaring mistake issue is that it was Aldridge was the one who was to procure the expert affidavit. It had nothing to do with Murphy.
Well, the facts of this particular case aside,
yes,
the bigger picture, I really am having trouble seeing the difference between a post-answer default judgment where we've said Craddock applies and a post-summary judgment new trial situation. I mean, I really don't see the difference.
Well,
yeah, I think maybe we shouldn't have said Craddock applied, but we did. So how do we distinguish that?
Perhaps a refining. If you do say Craddock applies, perhaps where the real key in this, and I think the court has already been hitting on both of us on what the standard is and should be, But Justice O'Neill set forth in the Medina case that the failure to take some action, which would seem indicated to a person of reasonable sensibilities under the circumstances, and if that is the Craddock standard, and if the court is going to apply the Craddock standard, whether it be at the motion for leave stage, whether it be at the motion for continuance stage, or whether it be post-summary judgment default stage, that is the standard that, quite frankly, might provide the court some guiding principle and able to judge the particulars of the case. And I don't think it's the negligence standard. I think it would seem indicated to a person of reasonable sensibilities, which hopefully would be a higher standard than just flat-out negligence, but would and keep the burden on the movement to do so. And secondarily, I can't say, and Justice Owens, you have already articulated this, it is fraught with problems in its application of the negligence standard, because as the court is aware, down in the trial court these days, the scheduling orders are more and more in place. You've got deadlines to file your dispositive motion. You've got the fast track level one or level two cases that have these trial courts. Getting this free pass might be it. And you've got yourself a jury. So there is a delay factor here, and there's a cost factor. And that's why I think before we brush over and look at maybe some of the equities, we ought to keep that we shouldn't. The answer isn't to lessen the standard for lawyers practicing in the state of Texas. We've got to have some bar that these attorneys practicing in these states that have agreed to of dates have calendared it and should be held responsible to that.
While you do not, I understand that you don't think Craddock should apply in this case because it's not a default. In fact, the non-movement did appear and participate in the proceedings. Do you think that Craddock should apply in the circumstances in which a non-movement wholly fails to appear and participate and a judgment is rendered against the non-movement?
My initial answer is no, but I'd be willing to give a caveat because I think it would depend on the circumstances of the default.
What do you mean by that? I'm talking about the case,
You've got the fast track level one or level two cases that have these trial courts. Getting this free pass might be it, and you've got yourself a jury. So there is a delay factor here, and there's a cost factor. And that's why I think before we brush over and look at maybe some of the equities, we ought to keep that we shouldn't. The answer isn't to lessen the standard for lawyers practicing in the state of Texas. We've got to have some bar that these attorneys practicing in these states that have agreed to of dates have calendared it and should be held responsible to that.
While you do not, I understand that you don't think Craddock should apply in this case because it's not a default. In fact, the non-movement did appear and participate in the proceedings. Do you think that Craddock should apply in the circumstances in which a non-movement wholly fails to appear and participate and a judgment is rendered against the non-movement?
My initial answer is no, but I'd be willing to give a caveat because I think it would depend on the circumstances of the default.
What do you mean by that? I'm talking about the case, just like not appearing for trial.
Yes.
You didn't appear for trial. You find out a judgment's been rendered against you. You run down to the courthouse with your Craddock motion for a new trial. Shouldn't if you had the same circumstance occur with respect to a summary judgment being rendered against a non-movement, shouldn't Craddock apply for the same reasons that it applies in a post, in a failure to appear at trial default?
I knew I was going to get this question. That is an extremely difficult question. My response would be no, and the reason why is I think we're still in the situation of a motion practice versus going to trial. I think the practicalities weigh against it. We're still in the procedural world of Rule 166A that sets forth the deadlines. And Your Honor, I think there's still some procedural remedies that allow the motion for leave to come in on the backside of it to assert that that motion. And I think trying to superimpose this test that was developed, I think, from as far back as I could go in the late 1800s, to a complicated motion for summary judgment practice, my answer would still be no.
Well, under Craig, you're really better off than people who are really, really late are better off than the people who find out just before the hearing. Isn't that right? I mean, in other words, the equities go to the guy that really blows it in terms of the deadline, as opposed to someone who discovers it just before trial or just before the hearing.
I think that is the problem in applying Craddock. That is a problem with applying Craddock, is because the guy who really blows it will get this conscious indifference standard, whereas the person who is fairly on top of it and misses a deadline, comes in and pleads himself on the court at the motion for leave status, has come up front and done it. And that's the inherent conflict by giving a benefit to somebody who's really blown it. And we've got the problem of somebody who, under this particular Court of Appeals holding, where you've had your notice, you've had your motion for leave, and you've had your motion for continuance. It's the only rule I can think of out there. I haven't found any other situation where your initial remedies have a higher burden than at your tail end, where the more you mess up, the easier the burden is.
Well, but the same thing would apply if I find out about a trial setting the day before trial and I go racing down to the courthouse because I know trial's about to occur, and I, with my motion for continuance in hand, and the judge says, no, sorry, we're going to trial, as opposed to if I just sit on my hands and let it go forward without me. I mean, we have that same scenario could arise in connection with the trial.
We do, and I think, you know, it is an abuse of discretion either in the motion for new trial phase or at the continuance phase, and we're perplexed. If the trial court can deny a motion for new trial, I'm sorry, a motion for continuance, you find out at the day before trial, but, you know, this was not on my calendar. And the court says, what almost every trial judge I've been faced, too bad. You're going to trial, just have your client here and get ready. Versus you find out about it the day or two after, and you're not there. I think, once again, you've got to apply and reflect.
We do have a different standard then.
We do have a different standard.
You get to use Craddock after trial, and on the other hand, you've got to go in and show good cause for a motion for continuance on the day of trial. So that's exactly the dichotomy we have set up.
That is exactly that dichotomy. If there is some middle ground, perhaps, it might be the Medina conscious indifference standard that could be applied. But I don't see why, and I've looked long and hard at the rationale behind why the Supreme Court had extended it to not appearing at trial. And I haven't really logically gotten that together. I got the no answer. That perfectly makes fit, but I can't fit it in with the
trial
stage. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the second clause, and we'll take another recess.
All right.